The reality for many of you is that investment properties where you live have become absolutely unaffordable. The good news is that there are many cities with affordable properties and many of those under 100K. If you're someone who's ready to buy your first out-of-state property in the next 4 months, then I encourage you to check out my free training that'll break down the process and show you exactly what it takes to invest out of state. I purchased properties out of state and it's changed my life. The same is possible for you. You simply need the right information. My free training will help you take that next step towards buying your first out-of-state property. You can watch the training right now at outofstatemoney.com, or you can click the link in the description of this episode. Again, you can find it at outofstatemoney.com, or you can click the link in the description of this episode.
Excuse me, may I talk to you for a second?
Yes. This is the Black Real Estate Dialogue, and the purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast, episode 229. Before we jump in, make sure to leave a rating and review wherever you're listening to this show. I love hearing from you, and I appreciate your feedback. And doing that takes less than 20 seconds, and it helps us get in front of more people and spread this information all over the world. I'm so excited for this interview today. I talk with J. Byron Brazier out of Chicago. He is working on a huge development on the south side of Chicago that's really going to transform the Woodlawn community. It's called Woodlawn Central, and I don't want to spoil it. So without further ado, let's get into it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast. If you're on YouTube, make sure you subscribe to the channel and like this video. If you're on the audio side, make sure that you follow the show and leave a rating and review. We definitely would appreciate it. Also, in the description on YouTube or on the audio side, a bunch of resources that'll help you get started in real estate investing. Very excited about this episode. Here with me today, I have J. Byron Brazier out of Chicago. Thank you for coming out, man. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me, Sam. Appreciate it.
Definitely. And got to give a major shout out to Chicago. We spoke about it a little bit off camera, but yeah. Love the city and looking forward to being back.
Oh, yeah. It's a wonderful city. The summertime is unbeatable.
Yeah.
There's no city like it. And this the skyline, the lake, you know, everybody is super active. And it's a great town and it's a fun town and people are super friendly.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So, a lot to talk about today.
Yeah.
You are the lead developer for Woodlawn Central, mm-hmm. Which will include 800 apartment units, boutique hotels, and a whole lot more. So I don't want to miss anything.
Yeah.
So first, we'd love if you could talk about the project, the scope of the project, what all it'll include.
Sure. I'll just give like an overview and then give you a little background on how we got there. So Woodlawn Central is an 8-acre development. And like you said, there's about 800 plus units, multi-income units for sale and for lease. And affordable housing is really important, I think, especially in this era of housing and the housing crisis that we're in. So we want to make sure that within our project, because it's from our community, we want to make sure that there's access to housing and the multiplicity of housing as well. We also have 215,000 square feet of commercial space. And that is geared towards entrepreneurship. So there'll be more densely, you know, concentrated spaces so that we can have small businesses as well. There's a black box theater, about 300 seats. There's Vertical Farm, which is about 530,000 cubic feet, which is about 53,000 square feet. We'll render about 3 tons of produce annually, so we can source for the community as well as have our own distribution. There's a 154 key hotel. There is a microgrid, which goes for our energy sustainability and our green energy model. Mm-hmm. So that way, if anything were to happen, that we would have energy to make sure that we were still supplying for our vertical farm, as well as our technology space, mm-hmm. which is we're looking to do a data center. Mostly for the community. It's not the big Google or Microsoft data centers that people mostly think about when you say data center.
Yep.
But this is really a catalyst to look at how you bring community into the industry, and to bring infrastructure into specifically the Black community, as there needs to be both social and economic sustainability. And so those are the key pieces. And then because the site, the 8 acres, is actually on church property, the Apostolic Church of God in Chicago, it's a very well-known church. They are partners in this process and see the need to make sure that the outreach is beyond the walls of the church and into the community. And I think that's also one of the great pieces about Woodlawn Central, is that it is bridging the gap in some of these very institutional spaces that are also in desperate need to also manifest in our community. And so because we're taking the parking, we're also doing a 9-level parking facility to replace that parking. And all of the different programs, you know, the cultural programs are anchored with residential. So when you say affordable housing, a lot of times that gets mixed up with low-income housing. And they're two totally different things. And affordable housing, you know, can go under the moniker of senior housing, artist housing, veterans housing, workforce development, workforce housing. So that is where we are looking to gear the idea of affordable housing being market rate quality at affordable prices.
We got a lot to unpack.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit more about the affordable housing piece, because anytime there's a new development in the Black community, that's the first question, right?
Right.
You're familiar with here, and I'm sure, you know, it's happening everywhere, right? You see these new buildings, and that's usually the first question. Well, is it for people in the community, or are there just going to be like 3 units set aside out of 100?
Right.
You know? So talk a little bit more about that, in particular the workforce housing. That's a concept that I don't feel like people know too much about. So I would love if you could just dive into a little bit more about what exactly is the workforce housing piece.
Sure. So one of the things about development in and of itself, it's a very niche industry, and it operates really on its kind of on its own ecosystem. And there are certain people who have been what I call anointed to build. And not all the time do you see Black development happening at this scale, because we don't have the land to do it. So the church actually owns the land, and it's unencumbered. So that gives a little bit of an extra edge. But one of the pieces about why gentrification is seen negatively is because of the displacement. And what happens is that the valuation that our industry uses is not valued on the grass, it's valued on the people, right? Because the grass on the south side is the same grass on the north side. And what they do is they take the AMI, which is the annual median income of that particular neighborhood, and they create a market study that says, well, the AMI in Black community is between, you know, $15,000 to $25,000 a year. So we can only build affordable housing, right? And then you perpetuate poverty within our community because of this scale that you're using. But then in order for you to make it market rate, now you're saying, well, I need to raise the AMI from 25,000 to 55 to 85,000. And so I've got to pull in people, you know, who I believe can pay that. And it's typically, in their view, not us. So they put in these commercial, you know, aspects, and all of this is really nonverbal communications, right? So when you see the renderings, or you see, you know, things that are nonverbally communicating, they don't gear towards us. So like people say, you see a Starbucks coming in, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
Right. And so that kind of has been the usual process that, that happens. And with workforce housing, it's important that when you hear this live, work, play, it's not just colloquial. right? You're actually living and working and playing in the same community that makes your economy cyclical, your local economy cyclical. So the work that I do within the community now goes back into other programs, whether it be health or education or economic development or safety. You know, all of those things get recycled back into the community. And so the idea of putting workforce housing into the community is one of the major infrastructures that make a healthy cyclical economy within the community. So the vertical farming would be our major workforce housing component. Yeah. So each cultural aspect has residential components to it. So the theater has artist housing, the vertical farming has workforce housing. And so when you live in the community, you get specific types of discounts, you know, because you are actually recycling your dollar back into your community. So when you hear, you know, the Asian community, their dollar stays in their community 6 months, where our dollar stays in 6 minutes. And that's why workforce is really important. And that's why workforce and entrepreneurship work hand in hand. So you have to give people an opportunity to come into a community that's fit and ready for a market because a workforce is there in some level of distribution.
That makes a lot of sense. So it sounds like the ideal situation would be if those working on the farm that's there with the produce and all that, they can live in the housing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, whether they're a chef, whether they have a boutique, whether they have, where they're working in the vertical farming or in the theater, we want to make sure that there is a healthy economy and a healthy environment that can grow and also be scaled. And Woodlawn Central is a micro version of a much bigger plan that the community of Woodlawn has set out as a 2060 plan for a smart Woodlawn. So we had to catalyze that. And so, you know, because that's a multi-billion dollar project and takes multiple years, you know, to put together. But the idea of showing that we need to build it from the inside out. And with that manifestation of the church and the community and this private public partnerships that are happening, then create almost a re-entry for those who have become successful, Black people who have become successful and who leave their community and move to other communities and spend their tax dollars in other communities that help their education and help their safety. Now there's a place that actually is geared for the success of yourself as well as the success of your future children or your current children or whatever. So this generational wealth conversation starts through generational practices, which is kind of what we're trying to do in Woodlawn.
Absolutely. And it's so interesting you mentioned the workforce housing, because everywhere is the land of super commutes, right? So people commute into the city because they can't, and this is everywhere, people can't afford to live near where they work.
Right.
And this is a great opportunity to reverse that, right? And in a very intentional way. And to me, if I'm an employee and I can afford to live literally right next to where I work, I mean, my morale is going to be great. Oh, I'll spend more time with my family and I'm going to work hard at my job because I'm, you know, I'm getting the opportunity to live here too. So I think it's a win-win if you ask me in that regard.
Absolutely. One in my studies, becoming a developer, I researched a lot. And one of the books that I found really interesting was Village Towns. And Village Towns are really kind of goes back to tribes in a sense. And in a village town, it's or a complete community, you work on the first level and then you live on the second level or you live in the back. And that is exactly what you're describing and is this opportunity to have a home, you know, and Those are the things that I think we've been missing for hundreds of, well, at least 100 years.
Yeah. Definitely. Talk a little bit more about the produce and just growing produce on the site as well, because that's something that you really don't see in the city. I mean, you know, you might see things here and there, small little urban farms and stuff like that. But talk about that and why that was a part of the project and just what you see as the benefits of that in the long term.
Yeah, of the vertical farming. So when we started looking at how to conceptualize around doing a development from the inside out, there's some very key pieces. Culture is one of them. And without having to relitigate our past, you know, we're missing some key pieces from an antiquitous standpoint of this is how we've done it for 10,000 years, right? Where other people get to actually benefit from those things, we almost have to make those things up in real time and then replace some of that cultural DNA with the current, you know, modern world that we live in. And so when you look at sustainability, food, water, shelter, you know, those are the three main pieces. But then having to create something that is not just, you know, static, you know, it has to actually render, you know, some other sustainability models from social to economic. That piece for vertical farming was really key, because agriculture is a part of culture. So when you're looking at food, that's a huge part of culture. And so when we started looking at it, we said, you know, here are the four corners of culture, which is performing arts, visual arts slash retail, technology as a replacement of language, and then agriculture as how we source our food and our nutrition. And we as a community suffer from two of the most silent killers of hypertension and diabetes that is really stemmed from our diet and the lack of good produce, the lack of nutritional foods tend to attribute to those two major health issues that we have in our community. So without having to be diagnostic about health, let's look at it prognostically and say, let's do vertical farming. Let's farm some of this produce ourselves.
That makes a lot of sense. Is the Woodlawn area a food desert?
Yes. Well, it had been for a really long time. There was recently a grocery store, a large chain grocery store that was put in. It's maybe about a mile from the Woodlawn Central site. But I think that, you know, without those corner delis, you know, in New York, I've lived in New York for a minute. You had bodegas, you know, you can always go and get food. You can walk outside your door and there's always food. And that hasn't been that way in Chicago for a long time, specifically Woodlawn.
Yeah. I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense. And you know, being in food desert, it's tied to a bunch of negative outcomes, as we know. So I think the fact that that is an intentional part of the project is, it means everything, you know, for those who live there, but also the community at large. And now, you know, you can have two opportunities to get fresh produce within a mile of each other. I mean, that just makes the way for more.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And, you know, the 2060 plan vision for Smart Woodlawn now looks at the entire community. And so Woodlawn Central is a micro version of that. So you actually have an entire agriculture district and a technology district and a performing arts district. We can have more than one theater, right? We're allowed to have more than one thing. Right? You say, oh, we already have that. No, we can have more, right? And that adds, you know, to the flavor of the diversity of who we are. And so, yeah.
Definitely. Can you share a bit more just about the Woodlawn community, just in general, the history, some of the challenges and some of those things? Because I want to make sure we put the community on the spotlight, you know. Chicago is an amazing city, and, you know, I think it's a great opportunity to put light on an area where maybe some people haven't heard of.
Yeah. Well, Woodlawn at one point had about 90,000 residents. It was a a bustling community. It had a lot of commerce. It had a lot of culture. It had a manufacturing district. There's a South Chicago manufacturing district. It's like at least 3 or 4 miles long. It goes from the mid city all the way to the east of the city. It was one of those, cities that, you know, it was after the Great Migration, you know, people went, a lot of blacks moved from the South to Chicago. And when the war happened, most of us stayed because we couldn't fight in the war during that time. And so we took a lot of those manufacturing jobs. And when the war was over and they came back, there was too many of us. And that's where that white flight came from. Mm. So a lot of the big brownstones and graystones and mansions and mini mansions that we have, you know, between Woodlawn and Bronzeville, were all at one time a very white community. And now it's 70% black. But there's a lot of Hansberry, Lorraine Hansberry came out of Woodlawn in the South Side, and Quincy Jones, and the list goes on and on. How many people have come out of Chicago, because it is the birthplace of gospel, the birthplace of house music, the birthplace of jazz and blues, and the Checkerboard Lounge, you know, that was there, very close to Woodlawn. Just, you know, when you separate the communities, they're not culturally separated. So when I mention certain things that are outside of Woodlawn at this moment, we're really about a South Side movement, and there wasn't a huge divide, you know, that we have now. But the community itself right now is poised to be that model community. They are ready and are very, very organized. Back in the 60s, Bishop Brazier, who is my grandfather, hosted Martin Luther King during the Civil Rights Movement. And one of my grandfather's biggest pieces was Black self-determination. And so he really put a lot of work. He wasn't just a pastor, but he was a community leader. He himself did about 17 developments within Woodlawn. And so... You know, there's that big piece that I could probably talk about a whole hour just on that. but there's a lot of history, and it's the reason why the Obamas wanted to be in Woodlawn was because of the church and because the community was organized. And Woodlawn is certainly and I may be a little biased, but in my view is the community that's going to model what I believe Black America, Afro America will look like in the future.
I love that. So what stage would you say the project is in?
We are just at the tail end of the strategic planning process, and we are working with the city right now, and we're going into what's called an intake. Mm-hmm. And that's where you get all your permits and your zoning, and we're getting the plan development amended to add the project to it. There's a few months that'll go into paperwork and this and that, and then ultimately a city council vote to amend the PD. And so that's where we're at.
Definitely. What's the PD for those of
you? It's called a plan development.
Gotcha.
Yeah, okay. We say PD, and it's a plan development 456.
Gotcha.
Really exciting.
What do you think might be the approximate cost of this project?
Well, we're looking at about $900 million.
Okay.
And I would probably estimate it'll go up to $1 billion, just how development works. It could even go up to $1.1 billion. And you know, we'll see how that works. I mean, we have our development team ready to go. We have our architects, you know, ready to go, all local architects. We do have some national architects who understand more of the district development side. Most of the the architects within our community don't get to work on projects this big. Mm-hmm. So it was really important for me to make sure that they were integrated, and they're also mostly women of color.
Nice.
Yeah.
Love that. Love that. So in terms of like financing, is it, what does that look like on a project? That's a massive budget.
Well, yeah, the financing is really interesting because the investment matrix has not seen something like this before, right? Typically you have your usual suspect developer who will come in and they'll leverage their assets and they'll bring in other partners to leverage their assets. And, you know, they'll bond the project and then they'll build it the best way they can. With this particular project, because it's done from the inside out, banks do not do pre-development. Mm-hmm. What they do is they give money to CDFIs, which are community development investment funds. And these CDFIs then support projects like Woodlawn Central at 100% loan to value and at maybe 5 or 6%, which is, you're not going to get anywhere else. some of the issues behind CDFIs, it could be a little slow. Mm-hmm. Once you get your pre-development, once you get your entitlements, which is your zoning and your permits, then your project, what they call in the industry, is a real project. And there's several ways that you can approach the funding, you know, for the project. You can RFP, you know, certain parts of the project, or you can bring in a general partner who wants to do the whole project. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're looking at.
Yeah.
And we're very close to finalizing, or not, I'm going to say finalizing, but we're very close to finding that right partner.
Yeah.
Because you have to have a shared vision. And it's important to have a shared vision when you're bringing in outside developers, because most of the people at this level don't look like you or mm-hmm. or me, right? And so you wouldn't necessarily go to a podiatrist for neurosurgery, yeah, right? Yeah. So you can't ask somebody outside of your community, do you have the best interest of your community to build your community? So we have to play a very intricate role in making sure that the culture that we're trying to build and the customs that we're trying to build stay intact for future developments. But you, as our general partner, our capital partner, still get your triple bottom line satisfied.
Definitely, definitely. For those who may not be familiar, what is an RFP?
It's a request for proposal, mm-hmm. Or a request for participation. And it's kind of a competition for developers, you know. So you have numerous hotel developers, and not every developer does everything. So when you're looking at a project like this, it's got a lot of different programs to it, because it's a campus project. And so you've got your residential developers, multifamily developers, you've got your commercial developers, industrial developers. And so we will have to then send out, you know, an RFP to those specific developers to see if they would like to participate and develop, you know, our hotel or develop our housing. That's not ideal, mm-hmm. you know, for us. But it's something that we can do. And I think from a financing standpoint, it allows the landowner to not put in so much risk, mm-hmm. And because development is very risky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And we talked about pre-development for a bit. So many people like who watch and check out different episodes, they have so many questions about, which is great, about the different parts of the development process. So can you just talk a little bit more about what is generally involved in the pre-development process?
Sure. So before pre-development, you have your strategic planning. So you do your concept master plan. Some people like to use primary instead of master. So, so these are your primary, you know, plan,
yeah.
Concept plan. And then you kind of give an idea. So Woodlawn Central, as you see it today, is the concept plan. Mm-hmm. And once you get through that and you say, okay, city, we want to do this, yes or no, they say yes, and they're like, great, now we can go into pre-development. That's where we get our general contractors together, our owner's reps together. The GC or the general contractor will work and find the right subs for, you know, each of the individual components and construction. You do the concept plan then turns into a detailed master plan or a detailed primary plan. And that is where all of your floor plans, all of your measurements, all of those things are now very finite. You know, you are looking at every staple, every piece of paper, every screw, every nut, every bolt is all accounted for in that process. And so all the construction documents that are built, you know, in that stage. And then once you get through pre-development, then you go into construction, and that is infrastructure. So everything that you don't see that's in the ground, your plumbing, your electrical, your streets, easements, stuff like that.
Yeah. I appreciate you breaking that down, because, you know, oftentimes people will drive by, they'll see, you know, wow, this building went up so quickly in 12 to 24 months. Yeah. And what we see as someone just driving up the street, you know, we see the process, but no one really thinks about what all had to happen before that. In many cases, could be years of work before you even put anything into the ground. So I appreciate you just detailing, you know, what has to happen behind the scenes.
Oh yeah. It's you can't Google the process. You got to live it, you know, and it is definitely not for the faint of heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it is, you know, once you understand it, you know, it's not rocket science, but yeah. You know, it does. You know, we spent, we did the 2060 plan, and we worked with Montana State University. They came down and they underwrote the concept plan for the Woodlawn community, which we were very, very appreciative of them for. And then the pandemic hit, and that stopped everything. And so I said, well, you know, one pandemic, it's not going to hold us down. Let's really think through this. And so we spent 2020 and 2021 building the concept for Woodlawn Central.
Yeah.
And so there's 2 years of just, you know, putting the renderings together, putting the narratives together.
Yeah.
And then now we're spending, so 2021 we announced, and now we're in 2023, and now we're just getting through, you know, the city part. Right. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people, you know, when they see projects like this, they want to be a part of it. And you have to be very mindful about what you need at that time. Right. Yeah. And you can't waste a lot of time and money that you don't have, you know, working in spaces or working around things that you don't need. And so you have to, when you get into the development game, your budget is very lean. And your concepts have to be very big.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. I love that. One of the things you mentioned earlier was there'll be some units for sale and some for lease.
Yeah.
So the ones that'll be for sale, would those be like condos?
Yes. Yes. One of the things within the financing portion of that is when you have a general partner, they're going to want a big chunk of their money back. Mm-hmm. And so sales lends to, you know, satisfying their triple bottom line. Mm-hmm. And so there'll be market rate sales, there'll be affordable sales, and then there'll be some luxury.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. So as far as figuring out that mix, it sounds like to beat the bottom line and you know, work with all partners, it's important to, for anyone who might be watching this, to consider how you might want to structure those things so that the numbers make sense.
Yeah. Typically, you know, when I would say back in about 2013, there was this third, a third luxe, a third market, and a third affordable. Mm-hmm. Within this housing crisis since then, it's been even more of a need for affordable housing. And affordable housing is subsidized quite easily, you know, from a government standpoint. But this is a private project, and so we are not bound by the ordinance of Woodlawn, which is 30%. Any projects on city land must be 30% affordable. But we did commit to the community that we would stick to the ordinance and that we would do 30% affordable within Woodlawn Central.
Definitely. One thing you mentioned too is just having a mixed income environment, which I believe is very beneficial. Some may not necessarily be too aware of that kind of structure because, you know, most often folks, their mind goes to like affordable, it should be affordable for everyone making a certain income. Yeah. However, there is a lot of value in a mixed income environment. So from your perspective, what would you say are some of the advantages for everyone in the community of having, you know, all of those units, but it's a mixed income and not necessarily one class of people financially, if that makes sense?
Yeah. You know, we were approached by one of our reps to make the project entirely affordable. And when you do the numbers, the cost of things today and the profit margins to do affordable don't mix. They don't make sense. And then in real estate has some very finite rules when it comes to natural assets and natural barriers. And what I mean by that is anything by water, transit, highly visible institutions, schools, parks, attractions, all lend to a market rate or luxury area. And then you have your natural barriers, which are cemeteries, train tracks, freeways, highways. Those tend to be your more troubled areas because you can't get enough commerce into that space. So it's a delicate balance of commercial and residential, in which we call mixed use. And to be able to make sure that it is profitable, you have to have a mix of income, you know, in there. So what we were talking about earlier is re-entry. Those of us who've become successful, who are in the six and seven figures, sure, we can move to, you know, Beverly Hills or the Gold Coast or Bel Air, but it doesn't really support the culture that now doesn't really exist, but could exist for the elements of sustainability, right? And so private investment into a community come from, you know, go to parks and programs. So when you go into affluent neighborhoods and you see parks named after people, it's because they paid for it. The city didn't pay for it. The state didn't pay for it. The county didn't pay for it. The feds didn't pay for it. The people who live there, who are the affluent pillars of the community, are the ones who shape the community and the culture of the community. So if we lack that private investment, then we lack any ability to invest generationally into our children. And so it's really important to have a mixture of income, but you also have to make sure that in a project like this, you're giving amenities or you're allowing amenities to be available in the community that would then draw that multi-income crowd.
Love that. In terms of amenities, what are you thinking? What's the vision?
Hey, we're talking like pools, arcades, restaurants, sports bars, you know, things that we do everywhere else but our own community. We put those things back into our community. We make sure that there's availability for whatever it is that you want to do. Woodlawn, we're right across the street from a major golf course. It's a South Shore golf course, which Tiger Woods was supposed to be redesigning. I don't think it's off the table, but it's been a little minute. But those are the types of things that I think, you know, our high earners within our community love to do is play golf, right? Have golf simulations. Really, really immerse our young people into AI and AR and VR, design, the entire STEM opportunities. Those are the things. Walkability is a key thing when you're looking at, you know, where do I want to live next? You know, what am I, what do I have at my disposal? Do I have to get in my car? Do I have to get into an Uber? Do I have to get on a train or a bus to get some of the basic things that I need? That is, I think that is a part of the amenity process.
Definitely. And I love that because, you know, obviously anyone can come and live down there, but there was a time when we all lived together, mm-hmm. like all income ranges and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I believe this is a great opportunity to get back to that, right? Yeah. And make it a desirable place for everyone and to have all the things that everyone values. And I think the social benefit of it is folks get to interact with people who they probably otherwise wouldn't be able to interact with and learn from and share experiences with. So in my opinion, I believe that's an additional benefit and it's going to be awesome.
Yeah. A colleague of mine says it's a black utopia.
And, I like that.
You know, and I agree. And I don't want to be too pie in the sky.
Yeah.
But these are not things that nobody else is experiencing. If you look at this at 30,000 feet, we are the only group of people who don't live together. You've got Chinatown, you've got Koreatown, you've got Little Italy and, you know, Greek town, mm-hmm. Ukrainian village, right? It is very customary for those who identify with one another culturally and physically that we understand the needs and necessities for a higher level of sustainability, both socially and economically. And so I know that all of us, you know, are not on the same page. And so I always kind of question, you know, who do I think I am, right? But I can't ask permission to do something that I believe that I've been called to do. I'm going to do it. And if you like it, that's wonderful. If you don't, you may eventually like it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it's one of those things that I struggled with early on was mm-hmm. knowing that we are divided and then saying, hey, here's some unification for you. You know, it doesn't always work that way.
Definitely. So you mentioned a calling, and it's been great hearing you talk just through the whole process. And I could tell this is like your world right now. And when did you feel called? And was there something in your background? I know you have the legacy of your grandfather, your father. Were you in real estate prior, or was this kind of like a shift of the direction of your life and something that, you know, you're like, I need to do this?
You know, I am an artist by nature. And so I am a very creative individual and have always been, you know, that kid who said, hey, can you draw this for me? Or, you know, do this. So, yeah. So I've always been that kind of creative thinker. And then, you know, my mother has been in real estate. She'd been in real estate. She's retired now, but she had been in real estate for 30 years. And so I'd go to all the showings with her and get all of the, you know, vernacular and colloquials and understand. She kind of taught me the business side of it. Even tried to get me to go to real estate class, but I just bored to tears. I take my hat off to all agents and brokers because those tests are brutal. When I decided that I didn't want to work for anybody anymore, because I couldn't get into a career where people would allow me to be me. Right. They want to be able, you know, I think the world is very, very interesting where they want to tell you what to do, but then they also want to tailor your response to what makes them feel good.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm just not that person. Right. So as somebody who is highly creative and individualistic, I needed to find an outlet where I could use those gifts. And so I went to my dad. I said, hey, you know, I want to start my own business, you know. And he was like, okay, well, you got to start with a business plan. And so he was the one who taught me how to write up a business plan. I was 25. That was 2005. And by 2007, I'd opened my first business. I renovated a warehouse in Chicago on the south side in Bronzeville. So at 30,000 square feet, I lived on one side and then had events and a gallery. And the whole idea was to really build an artist commune where Black artists could go and other artists of color could go to get the same level of exposure that we weren't getting anywhere else. And so when they started to gentrify Chicago, specifically in Wicker Park, that was where a lot of artists hung out. And that's where, you know, me and my friends, that's kind of our little stomping ground for a little bit. And when they started gentrifying it, it started, you know, the gentrification process is kind of like a sanitation process in a way, right? So all the artists started moving, you know, further south. And they started kind of matriculating to this community called Pilsen. And I had met some real estate people, let's say a real estate family in Chicago. They had a building. It was another kind of timber wood loft building, about 450,000 square feet. And it was an old macaroni factory. And they had maybe about six or seven tenants, just random. But a mutual colleague said, "Hey, you should really talk to Byron. He's, you know, got some really great ideas." And I had just kind of was going on closing up, you know, the warehouse as the owner, and I could not come to an agreement on how much the building was worth. Needless to say, the building doesn't exist anymore. They tore it down.
Wow. Yeah. What's there now?
Nothing. It's wow. just a vacant lot. But he had such an affinity to the building, you would have thought that, you know, but I had done such a good job at bringing, you know, synergy to that space. So many people wanted it. But he was trying to sell it, you know, for this exorbitant price. It was like everything that was there was because, you know, of everything that I had done. So I was looking for a new home, and this space came up. And so this I found was a really great opportunity. The building itself or the business itself is called Lacuna Lofts in Chicago. It has housed many, many artists. It has housed many, many businesses. It's about almost 12 years since its inception. So we opened in 2010. So it's, you know, it's 13 years. The original owners sold the building for millions of dollars, which wasn't what it was when I got there. But the idea was I used that as a proof of concept that says you can build something out of nothing. Mm-hmm. And it was at that moment I knew that no matter what I did, it was going to be successful because the intention was pure, and the intention was not for me to make a bunch of money. The intention was for that people would have a bunch of opportunities that they would not have normally had something like that not existed. And so a lot of people of color came there, and I made sure that the process and procedure allowed them the opportunity to have a space. So we didn't do any credit checks. We didn't do, you know, some of those systemic things that keep us out of certain areas. I made sure that that was not something that that was not a practice that we did. Mm-hmm. I don't know what they do now. I'm sure that they've probably, now that it's successful and you can't get into the space, but it was around that time. It was about 25, and I said, I've got to do something. And then I don't know what it is, but I know it's got to be a creative. I know it's got to be with artists. I know it's got to be with people of color, specifically, you know, Black people, and giving us an opportunity. As an artist, I'd never showed my own work. I made sure that other people were able to show their work, because you can't do you and others at the same time, mm-hmm. right? You got to pick which one you're going to do. You can't be famous and then say, oh, now I'm going to help everybody else. That's kind of got to be your thing, you know, on the onset. Not that famous people can't help people, but it is a very different journey. And in that calling space, I knew that that was what I was supposed to do, especially once I saw how much it had benefited the people that I wanted to support.
Definitely. Yeah. I love that. And how does it feel just to be leading the charge on this? And you mentioned your grandfather and everything he did in the community and the developments that he was able to do. And of course your father and the church and what they're doing in the community. You know, when you get 15, 20 seconds to sit for a minute, like how does it feel just to be leading the charge in the midst of all the craziness? I'm sure that is in the day to day.
Yeah. I never wanted to lead the charge. Mm-hmm. Because of the responsibility that mm-hmm. it takes to do something at this level, but there's nobody else who could have done it. And there's nobody else who could talk about it the way that I can talk about it. And I realize that is, you know, that is just what it is. And so I don't take a break mm-hmm. from it. I can't take a break from myself. it is just what I do. It is just who I am. And I enjoy every minute of it too. I really do. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What are some challenges that you've experienced during the process so far over the last couple of years?
Oh, the challenges actually have been more internal than external. Mm. Convincing or getting support for new concepts that take investment. You know, the generation who is leading right now have become risk averse. They like it just the way that it is. You know, it's comfortable. But for some of us beyond that generation, find it a bit dystopic, right? I can't find a peace in nothingness, right? And doing nothing is no longer an option. And getting that message across was the initial challenge, right? So when I approached Dr. Brazier about this, he gave me one lot.
What'd he say?
He was like, I'll give you one. I'll give you that back lot, you know? And I said, okay. And then I said, I need another one, you know? And he's like, all right, I'll give you. I said, no, I need them all. But I had to create the compelling reason why. And it was about sustainability, right? It wasn't about, oh, the church is going to make all this money and this and that, because that's not what our family is about. My grandfather wasn't about it. My dad's not about it. It's always been about the community and the church and making sure that the church stuck to its mission, vision, and objectives, and that through those mission and objectives, that the community would grow. But there has to be an additional intention to that, because now generationally the needs are different. And this was something, a part of the compelling argument was that this was a need. Right. Even the industry of church, so to speak, and I hate to call it an industry, but I think that that's the best way I can describe it. Even it in itself is changing. People are not coming, you know, and sitting in the seats. Right. You've got technology. They get online. They have living room church. Right.
It's true.
And you know, and it's, you know, and that's what it is. Right. And so we don't know what the future holds. There may be a future where cars are no longer necessary. There may be a future where, you know, being there and the people there are people actually from the community. So when you have these big mega churches, you have to be a church of the community, not a church in the community. And those are two totally different things. And kind of shedding a light on some of those missed opportunities to being a church of the community, I think, is how Woodlawn Central begins to, you know, work, you know, in those gaps and bridge those gaps from a spiritual standpoint to a social standpoint to a sustainability standpoint.
Definitely. I want to talk about the tech piece a little bit, because you touched on it a little bit, just AI and just different technology and things that will be a part of the project. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So technology is one of the four corners of culture in the strategy. And we're using technology as a replacement of language. And technology is a language. Coding is a language. And it is a modern language that we are not very familiar with as a group. And so the tech space is built as a resource. So there's a resource center that then focuses on education for youth and adults on AI, AR, and VR. So artificial intelligence, augmented reality, and virtual reality. And that could be in the space of coding. It could be in the space of design. It could be in the space of concepts. It could be space of research and development. We want to make sure that we're spanning out all of the different opportunities that are going to be a part of this new fourth industrial revolution that's happening, you know, e.g. technology. And so in that space, having access to equipment, having access to educational resources, having access to teachers and professors and the like, you know, is what I think is really important specifically in the Woodlawn Central space. And then there'll be office buildings or an office space for startups and startups who want to be startups. And, you know, just overall what, you know, what used to be called incubators is now called shared space. So, you know, it's those things. So we're not trying to be a WeWork. I already did that. I was WeWork before WeWork was WeWork.
Yeah.
And so it is, again, it is a cultural space concentrated for our community to kind of leapfrog these 200 years that we've been behind in some of these economic spaces.
I love that. And it's so interesting, just all the talk around AI, and it's some amazing stuff out there. There's a lot of fear behind it, but conversations I've had and thoughts that I've had is that we should lean into it, and the next generation needs to be part of the back end of this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, creating new technology opportunities with the AI space or whatever, or learning how to build and model and do all that stuff. To me, when you talk about the fourth industrial revolution, I believe that's where the great opportunity is for the next generation, in my opinion.
You're 100% right. You know, artificial intelligence is not real intelligence, right? They're humans who are adding to the pot of what AI is. And with every human comes a bias, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so if we're not in a part of the development of the AI, then the AI then becomes bias to the society that we live in. So we have to, I think this is where we're at a real fetal stage, you know, fledgling stage of AI, and we can be able to implement counter biases to the biases that are being developed in these spaces. So once you go on and you're, you know, you go into ChatGPT and you ask it a series of questions, and it'll give you the answers, but it's giving you answers based upon a series of biases. Right. And so if we are a part of actually creating linguistically, you know, what AI is a part of for the usage of our culture and community. And then also it helps others too, to unpack their bias as well. And actually not the truth, not be hidden behind code. Right. You can take away and ban books all you want. Right. But the information is going to be readily available with or without your books. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be a part of the process where that readily available information is. And there's nothing stopping us from doing that.
Definitely. Definitely. Well, this has been a great interview. Yeah. Just amazing project that's coming. I can't wait to see it. And keep an eye and watch things grow and develop through this process. And I appreciate that we were able to talk about different parts of the process so people really understand what it takes to work towards something like this. And it's a very unique project, extremely unique project. And I hope that it's something that can be replicated in other communities throughout the country. And yeah, I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, thanks. You know, just, you know, the replication of it, you know, is possible in, because even though the characteristics of our community may be different, the condition is still the same. And so if we're looking at the condition, then I think it can be replicable. But I thank you so much. You know, I appreciate, you know, your enthusiasm, what we're doing. You know, it gives us a boost, you know, to keep pushing on through, you know, through the highs and lows. So thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's my pleasure. And where can folks find you? Where can they keep up with what's going on with you and Woodlawn Central and reach out and all those things? What would be the best ways?
Yeah, woodlawncentral.com. And we have a monthly newsletter that you can sign up for. And we keep you updated on everything that we're doing. We've got some really great announcements that are coming out later this year. We're bringing on some new team members, and I'm really excited about them coming on and helping us gain more exposure.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, thank you everyone for watching another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue. If you're on YouTube, make sure you like this video, subscribe to the channel. If you're on the audio side, make sure to take a moment and leave us a rating and review. Thank you all so much, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue podcast. Remember to follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue, and be sure to leave us 5 stars and a review on your favorite podcast listening platform. Until next time.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
Save big this summer with great deals, all in the Kroger app. Get select varieties of Powerade or Body Armor Super Drinks for 79 cents each. Then get a 2-pound package of strawberries for $2.99 each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.